Thanks for joining us. You can always catch the latest sermon online, but we sure would love to see you join us in person to celebrate and support each other in our love for God, our neighbors, and this church. We are South Britain Congregational Church. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, you are welcome here. And now, enjoy another great Sunday sermon, and we hope to see you soon.
Our second scripture reading is a pretty well-known story from the book of Exodus, which is chapter 16, 2 through 15. The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill the whole assembly with hunger." And then the Lord said to Moses, "I'm going to rain bread from heaven for you. And each day the people shall go out and gather enough for that day. In that way I will test them whether they will follow my instructions or not. On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather on other days." So Moses and Aaron said to all the Israelites, "In the evening you shall know that it was the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, because he has heard your complaining against the Lord. For what are we that you complain against us?" And Moses said, "When the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and your fill of bread in the morning, because the Lord has heard the complaining that you've uttered against him, what are we? Your complaining is not against us, but against the Lord." Then Moses said to Aaron, "Say to the whole congregation of Israelites, 'Draw near to the Lord, for he has heard your complaining.'" And as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the Israelites, they looked toward the wilderness, and the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. The Lord spoke to Moses and said, "I have heard the complaining of the Israelites. Say to them, 'At twilight you shall eat meat, in the morning you shall have your fill of bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God.' In the evening quails came up and covered the camp. In the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine, flaky substance, as fine as the frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, 'What is this?' For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, 'It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat.'" A monk joined a monastery, and he took a vow of silence. And after the first 10 years, his superior called him in and asked, "Do you have anything to say?" And the monk replied, "Food bad." After another 10 years, the monk again had the opportunity to voice his thoughts, and he was brought in and he said, "Bed hard." After 10 years went by again, he was called in before his superior. When asked if he had anything to say, he said, "I quit." The superior said, "That doesn't surprise me one bit. You've done nothing but complain since the moment you got here." The Exodus, the leaving of Egypt and the crossing the Red Sea, was a monumental event for the people of Israel. And it was and remains the greatest singular event for the Hebrew people. This is the event that they refer back to in the psalm that we read this morning. And the prophets, it's a huge event in their collective psyche. The only one that even comes close to having any kind of similar impact is maybe the Babylonian captivity. And in the story from the passage that we read, and we've probably all heard, we're not long after this great Exodus, right? God and Charlton Heston Moses parting the Red Sea. That's the image that comes to mind, right? When we think of the Red Sea, you see Charlton Heston, and it's amazing, right? This part of the story is probably about a month after this huge and massive event. We're only 2 chapters further into the story, into the book, and now the wheels have come off on the great Exodus. The excitement of being free, the wandering in the desert has kind of lost this new and exciting gloss. The harsh reality of living as nomads has begun to set in. The rocks and the sand and the bushes are just not as exciting as they were when they first got there. The people, like that monk from the beginning of the sermon, have started complaining. They started grumbling. They started in chapter 15, they were worried about the water supply, and not just the water supply, but the water tasted bitter, it was sour. And we all know if you watch any survival shows on cable television, water is a very important thing. But the problem with this water was that it was bitter. It didn't taste good, but God was gracious and miraculously provides good tasting water to the Israelites. Moses actually throws a piece of wood into the water and it takes care of that. But now the food supplies that they had carried out of Egypt are running low. And then it starts. They begin to remember the past as being a little different than it was. They're hungry and they've forgotten about the oppression, the whips, the long days of labor, all the hardships of being in bondage in Israel, in Egypt, and all that they remember was that they had food. We call this revisionist history. They say to themselves, things were bad, of course, but not as bad as back then in bondage and oppression. At least then we had food to eat. In their own words, like it says in 6:3, would that we have died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the meat pots and ate bread to the full. For you brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. And if you don't speak whining, kind of, let me translate what it's saying. God, you should have just killed us in Egypt. That would have been the kinder thing to do. At least then we would have had full stomachs. But instead, you saved us all the way out here just to make us starve. Shame on you. That's my own rough translation of the Hebrew. But let's pause for a moment and recall something to our minds. This is the same God who did the plagues. Not one plague, right? How many plagues were there? This is a Sunday school test. 10? I heard somebody say it. Who was that? Is that you, Judy? No. Oh, all right. 10 plagues. Amazing plagues, right? Frogs, locusts, boils, hail, and the list goes on. This is the same God who just parted an entire sea. This is the same God who defeated the greatest military in the world at that time. Oh, and by the way, created the universe and everything in it. And this group complains and are worried about whether they'll have enough food. He just made water taste good by throwing a piece of wood into it. But they're worried about food. I got to be honest, does this strike anyone else as kind of absurd? Maybe a little? More than a little, right? When you read it like that, it's more than a little. It reminds me of the Mark Twain quote that says, don't complain and talk about all your problems. 80% of people don't care. The other 20% think you deserve it. That's Mark Twain. We learn about complaining from this passage because this group does it really well with gusto. They are artful complainers. And one thing that we learn from this passage about complaining is that complainers always find something to complain about, right? There are people I'm sure we know in our lives that can always find something to complain about. If it's hot, it's too hot. If it's cold, it's too cold. The food at the restaurant is either lacking or wrong, or the floor is not clean enough. Complainers will always find something. In the story from the Exodus, if it was not the water, then it's the food. If it's not the food, then it's something else. See, with the right eyes, you can always find something that's not great. You can always see the thing that's wrong. It's easy to find things to complain about because we live in a fallen, imperfect world. We know this reminds me of probably a lot of people, of Eeyore, right, from Winnie the Pooh. Eeyore, the great philosopher, said, I'm going to try to do my Eeyore impersonation, but I might have known, said Eeyore. After all, one can't complain. I have my friends. Somebody spoke to me only yesterday, and it was it last week or the week before that Rabbit bumped into me and said, bother, the social round, always something going on. See, this passage in the people, it sounds a lot like Eeyore. And another thing we learn is that grumbling, complaining is kind of a contagious problem. It may have started with a few, and then it grew into the whole assembly is feeling this. Everyone who was there was complaining about what was going on. And Moses passes the buck right to Yahweh, right to God. We can once again be quick to look at this story and say, how can the people do that? A month after experiencing the crossing of the sea, shame on them. But yet, brothers and sisters, when something is so clear like that, then it's usually a trap for us. We find ourselves in it, and we might be guilty of this too. Maybe we complain too. Maybe? Anybody wanna raise their hand? No, don't raise your hand. The ways in which we do it might look a little different than this, but we still do it in this life of faith. Why is it that we complain? We find ourselves in a culture that is teaching us that whatever we have, no matter how much we have, it's not enough. We're taught by marketing, by commercials, to one-up, do bigger and better than our friends, our neighbors, and other people. It's hard, if not impossible, to keep up with the Joneses, so it causes us to complain and maybe grumble a bit. In California, there was a house that, you know, and this is usually around Christmas time, but houses that kind of go a little overboard with their lights and Christmas decorations, and they had a little, maybe too much Christmas spirit or zeal. And the neighbors competed each year, upping the special effects. You can only imagine, like animatronics and lasers. So one house would have lasers, and the next time would have another. They would add more lasers, and yet the neighbors on the other side of this battle knew they were beat by these two houses. So what did they do? They took all the lights down, and they made an arrow and pointed to the house and said, "Ditto." I know that's like a very silly example, but when we are bombarded by this need to compete, show how much, even if we feel it necessary to even say ditto to compete with what was going on. We go into debt. The average household in America carries $15,000 in credit card debt, not to mention student debt and mortgages, all to keep up with the Joneses. When we do this or attempt to keep up and fall short, then we focus on what we don't have and then desiring more and more. And by doing this, we're saying, "God does not meet my needs." Even if we don't say that, that's what we're doing through our actions. There was another example, kind of a blog that was going around Facebook a while back, and a woman was writing to show her kitchen because she was talking about something about her kitchen, and everyone who was writing comments back kept writing about ways she could improve her kitchen. Be like, "You should think about adding marble countertops," or it was something that had nothing to do with the post, but this is what people were kind of responding. But the thing is, no one wrote, "Wow, how amazing that you have a fridge full of food. How amazing that you have a place to go to cook your food," and things like that. Why would the first response be, "How do we make it look better, fancier," as opposed to the ways in which it's blessed already? We do not think that we have enough. And that is a way of grumbling, and our eyes look first to see how to help others keep up, as opposed to the ways in which to show them that they're blessed. Another kind of hidden way we complain is because things don't go our way in the course of a day, which kind of becomes God's fault. And I'm going to walk us through this a little bit. We head out for appointment, and we get to the car, and there's a flat tire. And then we go to Starbucks to get our coffee or Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, I'm a Dunkin' Donuts person. And you go there, and they give you what? They got the wrong drink, right? It doesn't take long, you know. And then you get to the appointment, and it turns out the appointment was the day before. Right? Anybody else? Any? I see a lot of people are like, "Okay, that's good. That makes me feel better about my life." But it doesn't take long to utter that phrase. Maybe outside of our mind, maybe in our mind, we say, "Why me? Why me? Why today? Why me?" We may not admit it, but we're saying that not to ourselves. Who are we saying that to? God. We're saying because we feel that God has failed us. And we ask, "Why is this happening to me?" Another way we complain is when we're praying and hoping for something and it ends up different than we hoped, and we feel that God didn't answer it because it was not the way that we expected or wanted. And I think the Israelites ran into this in this story. Like, we're hoping for a job or promotion we prayed and everyone was praying for, and we didn't get it. And we asked for something that we feel we're entitled to. Most of the time, we're entitled, and we feel like that it's God's fault, and we kind of complain. So when something bad happens, we complain to God, yet when something good happens, we get the promotion, and the first thing is we don't give God the proper credit. We give him the blame, but not the credit for those things. So from this passage this morning, how do we stop doing it? How do we stop complaining in these kind of, you know, these more clandestine ways? We can realize together that grumbling, and we've talked about in different ways before, is just a gratitude problem. We forget the ways that God has provided for us, cared for us in the past, and how God will provide. This is what Israel does over and over again. That's why when you read the Psalms, and we read the Psalm this morning, and you read the prophets, it always refers back to, you know, even in the Ten Commandments at the beginning, it said, "I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt." God's doing that because they've forgotten this huge event. He's doing that because he's saying, I cared for you in the past. I met your needs in the past, and I'll do it again, but you have to trust that I'll do it again. So when we focus on how God is meeting our daily needs, then we're less likely to complain. When we focus on the good that God has done in our lives, we grumble less. When we're invested in the mission of what we're doing, like here in the church or the things in our life, then we have a vested interest in them succeeding, and we're much less likely to grumble. We'll be more active in making them succeed. When Israel was hungry, instead of going out and finding food, they complained about the lack. But the biggest way to combat grumbling in our lives comes by adopting the mentality that God will be just what we need. When we do this, we become grumble-proof. We become uncomplainable. Yes, I made that word up. And I don't think it's a real word, but we become uncomplainable. This ability to combat this mentality of grumbling and complaining, and God being just what we need, is tied to the very nature of God. When Moses asked on the mountain before the Exodus, when he asked, who should I tell Israel sent me? What's your name? How are they going to believe me that you're sending me? Like, I'm going to go in there, they hate me, you know, like all the things that I did to Israel. They're not going to be first ones to buy into what I'm going to say. What's your name? What do I say? And God said, Yahweh. And this was a tricky one in Hebrew, and it's a variation of the verb to be. So it's translated as, like, I will be what I will be. Or we do it as the great I am. I am that I am. But the subtle nuance to that could be that I will be what is needed at the time. When we know and trust that God will be what we need, meet our needs, that God is our all in all, as the song says, there's no reason to grumble and complain. God, just in this passage, gives and is just what Israel needs. They wanted food, and they got it. Imagine going out and seeing the dew on the grass and it becomes bread. This is what happened to the Israelites. Now, some scholars have argued that there's a natural explanation for this, and this is real. I'm not making this up. One person argued that there was this bug that secreted, like, bug secretion onto the I can't even say it without being like, you know, I mean, I've been hungry before, but bug secretion is not like, I think I know the difference between bread and bug secretion. But that's the natural argument. But this is the idea that all of a sudden you go out, and just as the dew covered the grass, bread appeared in the morning. But God being what they need bread, and without being able to grow flour and millet and all the things that go with that, and as we're about to make pies this week, it's a perfect example, right? Flour takes time to make and do all these other things. God was what they needed. He became miracle bread. And they called it manna, which means, what is it? Because they'd never seen miracle bread before. And they're not Wonder Bread. That's different. But they said, what is this stuff? And Moses is like, this is the bread from heaven, you know? And they're like, manna. It's like, what is it? The second thing is God knows that they need meat. So the quails appear in huge numbers. And there's another explanation for that too, where it was just like these fat quails got lost and ended up where they needed to be. But I like the miracle idea of like God just made quails appear. That's the kind of like where I am. But that's what they needed. They needed meat and they needed bread. And God was what they needed. And in this passage, God is just what is needed. In this passage, he's several things all at once. As you read through, he's a listener, a chef, a loving father, a desert guide. See, God is so large, God is so all-encompassing that he's able to be just what we need, no matter how much we grow or change or how much our needs change. And when we trust that he is just what we need, there's nothing that we lack. It's on us then and our thinking and our belief in culture that leads us to dwell, that it's, you know, that we need something more, but God is the God of the possible, as Greg Boyd, a theologian, said. God knows us and loves us enough to hear our complaints and is gracious and loving to Israel and gracious and loving to us. God does not want to hear us complain all the time. He gives us grace here in this passage. He gave them what they needed, but there was a reason. In 16:4, he says, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not. God gives us grace, meets our needs to see what we do with it. God gives us what we need to see if we really believe that God is enough. Especially now in this age when we're told over and over again that we should have everything we need and want, but that's not scriptural. God promises to be what we need. And he looks to see if giving us what we need, are we content in that? Are we happy in that? Are we going to praise God in that? Woody Guthrie, the great musician, wrote a lovely song, and he didn't actually get a chance to put it to music. He wrote the lyrics, and I think, I can't remember what he suffered with at the end of it. I forgot to Google exactly what, I think maybe Parkinson's, but don't quote me on that. But Woody Guthrie wrote this beautiful song because he was going through a lot at the end of his life, and he never put it to music. Somebody else, other folk musicians, put it to music. But he wrote this song called God's Promise, and he said, "I never did promise you crowns without trials, food with no hard sweat, your tears without smiles, hot sunny days without cold wintry snows, no victory without fighting, no laughs without woes. But all that I promise is strength for this day, rest for my worker, my light on your way. I give you truth when you need it, my help from above, undying friendship, my unfailing love." See, Woody Guthrie is tying into this idea that God is what we need and not everything that we want. And that we can be, that can be where we miss the mark. The Israelites may have wanted something more. Maybe they wanted more than quails. Maybe they wanted more than manna. But that's what they needed. This would keep them alive in the desert. Brothers and sisters, God wants to see if by meeting our needs, we'll follow God, we'll love God, seek God. It's a test, and we get a chance to try and pass each and every day. Sometimes we fail, but when we try, we get better, and as we try, we do grow and grow. We reinforce this, focus on this each time we utter the Lord's Prayer, right? Every time we say the Lord's Prayer, what do we say? Give us this day our daily bread. Jesus isn't making that up. It's like, oh, like in the desert. Every single day they went out. So we're saying the same thing. We're saying, God, this day, meet my needs. Give me the things that I need today. Give me this day my daily bread. So like the Israelites before us, when we adopt this mentality and our minds tell our eyes to see the abundance and not the dearth, see the blessings and not the curses, see the good and not the bad, the truth and not the lies, see how our needs are really met daily. So we need to really ask ourselves, is God just what we need? Are we seeing the things in our lives in light of this, and the pangs of jealousy and desire for more and more make headway into our hearts and minds, and grumbling subtly or overtly bubbles from our lips and hearts, and we're able to take pause and look around and see how our needs are being met, like food in the fridge, families, friends, and a church that loves us, a place to live, and say, God, you are amazingly just what I need. Let this be our daily prayer. God, you are just what I need. Amen.